Welcome to The Europeans, the world's favourite and perhaps only weekly podcast about Europe that refuses to talk about Brexit. I am Dominic Kramer, an Englishman in Amsterdam, speaking to my good friend Katie Lee in Paris. How's Paris treating you, Katie?
Bonjour. I'm feeling very sophisticated today because normally when we're recording this, I'm in my pyjamas. But today I'm on my way to my very first French wedding, so I'm all dressed up to the nines.
Oh, get you. I am in my pyjamas, I'm afraid.
That does not surprise me. But yeah, you might remember I missed what was supposed to be my first ever French wedding because of the Gilets Jaunes protests and having to cover them.
So they're redoing it for you?
Yeah. No, it's a different couple. So congratulations, Claire and Leandro. So that's what I'm doing today. What are you doing?
I've got a performance this evening. So yeah, I got up very early for recording this podcast, despite the fact that I'm going to have to be singing very late tonight. So I'm very dedicated.
Which one's this again? I always lose track.
This is an opera about called Girls of the Golden West, about the gold rush in America.
Oh yeah, cool.
Just opened this week. Yeah, it's quite an interesting show, I think.
Mm.
Before I go and sing as a racist minor on stage all evening, we've got some people to interview, haven't we?
Yes, we do. C.N. Lester, singer-songwriter, author, LGBT campaigner extraordinaire, is joining us from London to talk about being trans in Europe. And a bunch of other fascinating stuff, including how being transgender works in other languages. And friend of the show, Mick Terrayhorst, founder of the magazine Are We Europe, is going to be calling in from Brussels to talk about the European elections and why you young people, you pesky young people, should be getting out and voting in them.
We don't count as young people anymore, do we?
No. We also can't vote. Yay!
Can't we?
No. Looked it up. But maybe we should get into that later. Have you got anything, first of all, for Commemoration Corner this week?
Yes. I've got something, but it's not really something to celebrate. Sorry for the Debbie Downer at the beginning of the episode. But it is 50 years since Swiss men rejected women's suffrage at the ballot box. As we've discussed before, Switzerland is famed for its direct democracy, whereby many important and actually sometimes not so important topics are voted on directly by the masses. However, in 1959, women were not granted the right to vote, and it would in fact take until 1971 for women to finally gain voting rights. The BBC has put together a really nice video about this referendum, centred around an interview with Ruth Dreyfus, who would later go on to become the first female president of Switzerland. We'll put that video in our show notes.
I was reading the last Swiss canton gave women the right to vote in 1990 on local issues. Isn't that insane?
Wow.
But luckily, we have people like Flavia Kleiner. Do you listen to that episode? It was our one-year anniversary episode. Kind of leading the fight now, and things are a little better. So that's good.
Yay. And to cheer everyone up, shall I start with Good Week?
Do it. Who's had a good week, Dominic?
Well, it's been a good week in my eyes anyway for the Luxembourgish Prime Minister, Xavier Bettel. Bettel is a gay married man and he used his powerful position to make a brave statement to Arab leaders this week. In a speech at the EU Arab League summit in Egypt, he reminded the guests that in many of their countries he would be classed as a criminal simply because of who he is married to. Highlighting that in some of their countries, he would in fact be punished to death. There were reports that his comments were received with a mixture of icy silence and quiet joy. Bettel responded to the reports on Twitter saying, "To say nothing would have not been an option." Bettel married his architect husband soon after Luxembourg legalised same-sex marriage in 2015. And fun fact, there are currently three LGBT European world leaders. One we mentioned last week, Serbia's Ana Brnabic and Xavier Bettel. So there's one missing, Katie. Can you work out who it is?
No.
It's Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
Leo Varadkar.
Of course, Leo.
Anyway, I doubt that Bettel's intervention is going to change anything anytime soon in Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia, Sudan and Yemen, all of which punish homosexuality with death. But it is nonetheless vital that these representatives feel some pressure from other world leaders about their despicable homophobic laws. So thank you, Xavier Bettel, for standing up for the LGBT community this week.
Yeah, it's really nice to have someone tell it like it is. It sounds a bit like that moment from Love Actually, where Hugh Grant goes off script and like sticks it to that really pervy American president.
I can't remember that scene at all. I can only remember the scene in the taxi with Martin McCutcheon where one of the kids is dressed in like...
as an octopus.
A fish, as an octopus outfit. It's so good.
How can you not remember this one, though? It's iconic. I'm going to send it to you.
Who's it been a bad week for, Katie?
It's been a bad week for relations between our two countries of residence, Dominic, France and the Netherlands, because France got some unwelcome news in the form of a very sudden announcement that the Dutch government has bought a chunk of the wonderful airline company that we know as Air France KLM.
Do we actually know it as Air France KLM, or do we know them as Air France and KLM?
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't actually know that they're one country because obviously they operate as two separate brands. But they are indeed one company. They have been since they merged in 2004. It sounds like a really boring business story, but bear with me because this company is actually pretty chaotic and it plays into lots of entertaining national stereotypes. The two companies merged in 2004. Since then, it's been a little bit rocky, to put it mildly. It's an open secret that there's been a big clash of working cultures and like national cultures between the two. If you had to reduce it to simple terms, quite a lot of the Dutch KLM staff think that the Air France people are unproductive and go on strike all the time, which I think is a view shared by quite a lot of Dutch politicians. And the Air France people think that the KLM staff are like smug and just think about money all the time and don't know how to live. There was quite a funny internal report in 2017, which got leaked, which showed what the two sides think of each other. And it revealed all these points of tension, like the KLM staff saying that the Air France people are aloof French people. Who would have thought it? And they got annoyed at stuff like, I don't know if this is still true, but back at the time in 2017, the French staff got subsidies on their lunches at the airport canteen. So lunch for them in the canteen only cost €4, but the same lunch cost KLM staff €10.
Whoa, that's a scandal. And Dutch people would not like that.
They would not like it at all. And there was this quite funny quote from a French manager saying the Dutch managers think they're, quote, super cool. So there's this really big culture clash between the French and Dutch halves of this massive company. And that really hasn't been helped by this really long and damaging wave of strikes by French staff over the past year, which has cost loads of money in terms of flight cancellations. And KLM is now the profitable bit of the company, which wasn't the case actually back when they merged. And I think quite a lot of KLM staff feel like their hard work is propping up the lazy French staff at Air France, who are quite often on strike trying to get more pay. Another French stereotype, which in this case is kind of true. So fast forward to this week, the Dutch government said very suddenly, we're going to buy 14% of the company, which the French government did not like at all, mostly because they weren't told beforehand. They were told an hour before a press conference that was going to announce the decision, which the French government described as unfriendly. What does it mean now? Well, both governments now own about 14% of the company, so this puts them on a pretty similar footing. And I think for the Dutch government, this was just about making sure they had about the same amount of influence over this massive company as the French government, especially because the holding company is based in Paris. And I think until now, for KLM, it's often felt like decisions get made there at HQ. It hasn't been a very happy week for France, especially because their nose has been put out of joint. And actually, the investors didn't like the decision that much either. Shares in the company dropped 11% in value after the news. Apparently,
ooh, ouch.
Yeah, because they were worried that the airline would just become this like battleground for competing national interests, which may or may not happen now. Watch this space.
It does sound like a pretty stupid decision not to talk to the French government about it, but presumably there's some like businessy reason why they had to keep it secret.
Businessy reasons, I don't know. We're not scientists in this podcast. We're also not business experts. It is possible, yeah. Or maybe they just thought the French are going to get really pissed off about this. Should we just do it and tell them about it afterwards? Either way, they were not very happy.
No.
Fun fact, by the way.
Yeah, go on.
Your king, Dutch King Willem Alexander, regularly works as a co-pilot on KLM flights so that he can keep his pilot's license.
Really?
Isn't that great?
Do they tell the passengers that the king is flying the plane?
Maybe he does a little intercom. Wouldn't it be great? Oh, I guess he's the co-pilot, isn't it? I was going to say if he was like doing the trolley up and down, that'd be amazing.
Presumably they keep it quiet because of security reasons. But that's super cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like cool, like the fact that the Prime Minister of the Netherlands also still teaches, spends one morning a week. I'm not sure actually if it is that much. But up until recently, he was teaching one morning a week at a school teaching citizenship classes.
Oh, that's so great. Ugh. I feel like the Dutch have come out of this story a bit better than the French. That was not my intention. I'm still very loyal to my country.
But they were very unfriendly to the French, so they've not been all good. So now we're going to be calling up C.N. Lester, who's an academic, writer, a fellow classical musician, and an LGBTI activist. CN has written their first book, Trans Like Me, and it's having its mainstream paperback release this week, in fact, on the 7th of March. It is a beautiful and personal exploration of the pressing issues facing the trans community today. So we decided to call up CN and find out a bit about their life. CN, thank you for joining us. Your book, Trans Like Me, has its mainstream paperback release on March the 7th. I picked up a copy in my local bookshop in Amsterdam the other day, and I'm whizzing my way through it and really enjoying it. But I wanted to start by asking, who did you write this book for?
I think there's that really lovely insight from Toni Morrison where she says that you need to write the book that you need to exist in the world. So I think primarily I was probably writing it for myself when I was a teenager and trying to find out, like, you know, who am I? What's going on in the world? What does gender even mean? What does sex mean? And it was really hard to find information that was readily available in sort of mainstream bookshops that wasn't just like the tragic memoir, you know, oh my God, my life is so over because I'm trans. So I wanted to write something that was informative and positive without being saccharine and had that mixture of sort of personal details, but actually really rigorous research as well. So I guess for me, for a really bookish, lonely transgender teenager. But hopefully you don't have to be a lonely bookish transgender teenager to enjoy it.
I mean, the thing that I think is really cool, I've read a few reviews online saying it's the book that you want your cis friends to read, right? It's for people who are open and want society to be kinder to trans people, but they're not entirely sure necessarily like how to talk about this stuff. I just think it's a really great and important book.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's like, where do you start? Because the media coverage of trans people, you know, certainly in like Anglophone countries, is usually pretty appalling. So even people who have open minds and open hearts are often working with a set of information that's just flat out inaccurate. So yeah, we didn't want to assume that people would know a huge amount of information about trans lives, but neither do we want to assume that people were stupid and needed spoon feeding or couldn't handle complexity. So we figured, you know, let's treat our audience like they can, they can think, they can work things through, but maybe they'll want to know a little bit more than they're usually given, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does definitely. You talk in your book about how important finding the right words to describe your own gender identity were for you. Could you tell us a little bit about that process, if you feel comfortable doing that? Because the descriptions people use to describe these days aren't as simple as just binary identifiers of gay, lesbian, straight, trans, cis. There's a whole plethora of options that are available.
I grew up, you know, thinking about that period, late 90s, early 2000s, where, you know, saying like, oh, I don't do labels was really common. And it was also very comforting. But the problem was, in that vacuum without anything, the only words that I had for people like me were the words that bullies were using at school. So things like, you know, freak and dyke and faggot and that kind of stuff. And I really love this idea that rather than looking for a label, what you're looking for is a marker on a map. So if you look at, I don't know, a mountain on a map, it doesn't tell you just how beautiful and awe-inspiring it is, but it does show you how to get there. So for me, finding words like transgender and genderqueer, it doesn't sum up the complexity of a human being because no word possibly can, but it does show you that you can exist and that you can find other people like you and you can find resources for people like you. So I would just say that with any words that we're encountering now, you know, new words, things like demi-boy or demi-girl, which certainly weren't being used when I was a teenager, through to, you know, people reclaiming and reusing things like transsexual. I've even seen people reclaiming words like invert from the 19th century. We're trying to just like find our ways to being authentically ourselves, I think, rather than being prescriptive about it.
And these days, if I asked you, like, how do you describe your gender identity? Like, what would you say?
It depends on what kind of mood I'm in on the day. One of the things which is probably true for everybody is that who we are feels universal, right? So when people say, you know, describe your gender identity, I feel like going, oh, well, you know, it's the standard one because that's my experience. That's who I am. And then you realize that actually that goes against an awful lot of what the world is telling you. I really love the word trans because it's so open-ended. And that's kind of how I feel about my experiences of sex and gender and bodies and societies, is it's very varied. It depends an awful lot on how other people act towards me. It depends an awful lot on sort of how I see myself in different types of cultural spaces. So yeah, I like saying trans because it doesn't fit into one place. It kind of encompasses that question even within its own answer.
And can we stick with words for a second and talk about pronouns? How does it feel when people use the wrong pronouns to describe you?
It can be a mix of different things. When people do it out of ignorance, it can be anywhere between, oh God, you know, fine. You know, you don't see me and I don't feel seen. To, okay, you know, I guess that's where we're working from. How do we move on from there? People using deliberately incorrect pronouns, it is just genuinely one of the biggest fuck yous you can do to someone. When you say to a trans person, hang on, you're incorrect about your own life, what you're effectively saying to them is either you're a liar or you're delusional. And I'm not a liar and I'm not delusional. So deliberately misgendering me is one of the rudest and kind of most pathetic things a person can do. I mean, you find it a lot online as people will send you a lot of hate mail with this kind of misgendery, you know, your pronouns are actually this. And you think, are you five? You know, but it's sad.
Because you prefer the pronoun they. This got me thinking, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but does that work in other languages? I work in French quite a lot of the time, and I don't know how trans people do it in France or in Spain or in Italy, where the languages are very gendered. Do you know how it works?
I've had some conversations with people when I've been sort of traveling around for work, and it seems to be that the answer depends on the person and depends on like particular regions. When I went into Barcelona Pride, a lot of the people I was talking to there talked about switching between male and female. Some people in France I've spoken to use il, I-L, and then an E on the end. A lot of people use neopronouns, so they're sort of making something up and seeing what they're doing. It's definitely a challenge. You know, I feel very grateful that English has that singular, or, you know, they can be used in a singular, and that has a long history. It's definitely made my life a lot easier.
It's one of my favorite things about English is that we don't explicitly, anyway, gender our nouns, whereas most European languages, every object has a gender. I feel like it like embeds the binary nature of gender into those societies even stronger than it does in English-speaking cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's definitely something I've found, particularly traveling in France, which is, you know, probably the part of mainland Europe that I spend the most time. Last time I was there, the people we were staying with, it turned out that they had been sort of really investigating non-binary gendered options themselves. So they were coming up with all these sort of beautiful endings of words and, you know, could you combine this or could you, I don't know, there was so much creativity there. So I love that sense that maybe the language isn't fixed and it's okay to say, okay, we've been doing it that way for hundreds of years, but our needs change. So we can change the language as our needs change.
You mentioned a European Union survey in your book that looked, I think it was back in 2014, it looked at how trans people get treated across the continent. And it's pretty clear that there are the same kind of problems everywhere, right? Like trans kids get bullied at school, everywhere. People face public harassment and abuse all the time, everywhere. But I was wondering if there are any countries in Europe or maybe elsewhere that you think are particularly good or maybe just less bad in terms of offering support to trans people?
Really mixed. And that's the only thing I can really say is whenever you're looking at any individual country, some countries will sort of step forward and be doing so much better in one arena and then they'll really fall back in another. Anyone listening, if you're interested in this, I would definitely recommend TGEU, so Transgender EU, which is sort of the EU-wide organization for trans rights. Something that they really work on, which so many people are shocked to hear, is the fact that the majority of the EU, I think it's every country apart from five, you have to be sterilized to be legally recognized as your gender. Oof. And even a country like the UK, which claims you don't have to be sterilized, in practice, trying to get legally recognized as your gender without providing proof of sterilization surgery can be very, very hard. And you're often not allowed to save eggs or save sperm before you have genital surgery. So effectively, you know, banning further family options. The Netherlands really, you know, is doing a pretty amazing job. Outside of the EU, there's a lot of great stuff happening in Canada. I'm very lucky that half my family is Canadian, and I can go over to Canada and I can be recognized as neither male nor female legally. But even there, you've got huge problems with institutional transphobia and institutionalized abuse of trans people, particularly in prisons. There's no sort of paradise anywhere, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But are you feeling optimistic in this day and age that things are getting better and will continue to get better?
I'm feeling really optimistic about the people working to make things better. So I don't know what's going to happen in terms of overall politics, but the efforts of activists of all ages and the broadening of that activism that we're starting to see, like families of trans kids coming in and friends of trans kids and people's partners and their colleagues joining us and saying, you know, trans rights are human rights. This is a fundamental human rights issue. That's making me very hopeful. That's what I'm clinging to when, you know, you look at the news and you see so much division and so much, I don't know sort of how to describe it again in language, which isn't just, if you could see me now, I'm throwing up my hands and making a face.
Unfortunately, this is the radio, CN.
There's a lot of people with their heads really far up their asses, and they seem completely uninterested in advancing human society and trying to make the world better for all of us. And it's very easy to feel despair looking at that. But on the flip side, when you start looking at the people doing the work on the ground, yeah, there's a lot of hope there.
You also talk about the fact that in your book that a lot of dramatizations of the lives of trans people or television series that feature trans people have actors or are written by people who aren't trans themselves. How do you think this can be changed, or do you think it is being changed already and things are improving?
I don't know. Sometimes it's getting better, but then sometimes stuff comes out and you just cannot believe how bad it is. I was getting kind of hopeful that we were moving away from this really fake idea of what it is to be trans. And then this movie called Girl came out. Have you heard about it?
Yeah, I've actually seen it.
I haven't.
Ah, it's a Belgian film. And it came out at the end of 2018. And I run a trans arts night for Barbican in London. And it came out, and me and my director, I mean, we just sat there with our jaws on the floor, just going, what, this again? I mean, oh my God. It's like everything wrong with cis depictions of trans people in one horrible package. So no trans people are involved, obviously. Like, it bills itself as a trans film, but, you know, we haven't got any trans writers or directors or actors, because then it would be accurate. It's just this horrendous fake story about a trans girl who's played by a boy, obviously, with this insistence of like focusing on her genitals, which is not even biologically accurate for where this character is described in terms of transition and hormone blockers. And I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil this for everybody. It finishes with just like a horrendous act of self-mutilation, because it's impossible to focus on trans people without this tragic story and this idea that, oh God, you were born in the wrong body and you have to be, you know, here's the story of your suffering and your suffering and your suffering. And yeah, we suffer, but that's not the truth of our lives, not this depiction, this voyeuristic outside gaze. And when you look at work created by trans people, we do talk about the ways in which we suffer discrimination and suffer from prejudice. But we've got a lot more to show the world than that. And we have the agency and the authority to describe that in ways that aren't just turning us into victims for other people to sort of... Again, I'm making some hand movements here.
Is there any TV show or film that has got it right?
The Wachowski sisters.
Oh, yeah.
Check out... oh, my God, my brain has completely gone...
Sense8.
That's the one. Yes, check out Sense8 and just see how different it is. There's some great indie cinema, obviously. A filmmaker called Jason Barker has made an incredible documentary called Deal with the Universe about being a pregnant trans man. And it's funny and it's gut-wrenching and it's just one of the most glorious documentaries I've ever seen. So if you live in a city, check out the cinema listings, particularly around Pride Month, because it will be touring Europe.
Yeah. I've just realised that we did that whole interview without talking to CN about the fact that we're in the same classical music he's singing business, and I should have asked them a question about that. What's wrong with me?
I had a question about that too, but there's just so much other stuff to talk about. CN's book is called Trans Like Me, and it is out now. They're also a very talented singer-songwriter, several strings to the elbow there, and you can find links to all of their work in general at cnlester.com. Let's talk about the elections, Dominic. As mentioned at the top of the show, as Brits, still not clear whether we're going to be voting in these coming elections because of B-word. But I did look it up. You do need to be an EU citizen in order to vote. You can't just be resident in an EU country. So unclear whether we're going to be able to vote in these elections.
Almost certainly not then.
Probs not, I'm going to say. But anyway, as like possibly disenfranchised people, it is still very important to us that people who can go and vote do get out and vote. However you're planning on voting, and for whatever party, Mick de Rayhorst from the magazine Are We Europe is launching a new campaign to get youngsters to the ballot box, and we wanted to know why it was so important to him. So we gave him a ring in Brussels. Mick, hello. You're better known on this podcast as a purveyor of beautiful European magazines, but you've now also launched a campaign ahead of the European elections. What is it? Tell us about it.
Even though normally we have an editorial line where we try to steer away from Brussels and sort of the overarching election news, which is often portrayed in national media. But then we had a big look in the mirror as an editorial team, and we thought this is just too important to just leave to the side this election cycle. So we sort of initiated a campaign that's called Prove Them Wrong, where we focus on challenging young people to actually be a part of this election cycle, these elections, and sort of prove the stereotypes and the myths that sort of hang over our generation as being not engaged, only on social media, not voting. And I mean, they're not only myths and stereotypes, some of it are facts. But we want to sort of challenge young people to prove those stereotypes and those ideas wrong by, in massive numbers, going to the ballot boxes during European elections in May 2019.
How bad were the youth turnout numbers last time there was a European election?
So in the Netherlands, where I'm from and where we launched this campaign now, it was only 18% from people between 18 and 24.
Not good.
Yeah, that's not good.
It's really not good. And in countries like Slovakia and Eastern European countries and even Southern European countries, it's very, very low as well.
As you say, this is a problem that we see everywhere across Europe. And frankly, like sometimes as a Brit, when I look at the options available at the ballot box, like it is kind of difficult to be angry with people that say, oh, the options available are rubbish, I'm not going to bother. What is your counter argument to that? Like, what is your argument for saying, you know what, this really does matter?
Well, the only counter argument I can make, because I totally understand the disillusionment and sort of the frustration with current day politics, whether it's on a local, national, European or a global scale, we totally understand that. We are disillusioned ourselves, but the only thing we can say is that at this level, the most important challenges of our time, climate change, but also migration, job markets, they are decided through election campaigns now and through the politicians that we elect into office. So if we as a younger generation like massively go out and elect people who have those issues that we care about as a generation, whether that's on the progressive or the conservative side of things, but these overarching issues that mostly affect us, our newer generation, if we elect people that have those at the forefront of their policies and of their agenda, then we can actually do something about it and have people in office who do care about these issues that we as a generation also care about.
People are saying that like this election could like be the beginning of the end of Europe, and people are really worried about it. Do you think that's a bit over the top, or do you actually think that this election could change things drastically?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question, because on the one hand, people are holding sort of indeed sort of almost the future of Europe is almost on the ballot here, they argue. At the same time, we've seen that Europe, while having influence in certain areas, I mean, it will never be overshadowing or overarching national policies for the time being. So I think if all things go tits up, as the British would say, during these elections, I don't think it's the end of Europe yet, but it will definitely prove that even the European institutions, which are mostly sort of left to people who either love Europe or who definitely hate Europe, like Nigel Farage, those are the people running for office on a European level. if that is infested by enough people who don't have a constructive approach towards Europe, I think it could definitely change things. At the same time, there's more checks and balances built into these institutions than in some national institutions.
So your campaign is called Prove Them Wrong.
Yeah.
What does it consist of, and how are you looking to build it up?
So basically, we thought, let's not start something from the ground up. It costs a lot of time, a lot of money. So we intend to be a sum of all parts sort of campaign. And instead of trying to figure it out all by ourselves, we want to include as many partners as possible. So in the Netherlands, we have over 30 partners now, ranging from small organizations that look at diversity and inclusivity, but also bigger organizations who work to increase voter turnout on a national level, or campaigns that specifically focus on getting more women elected into office. Some can provide locations for events or social media capabilities. So every partner brings something unique to the table. By including them all and letting them bring their own expertise to the table, I think we can achieve much more than trying to set up something in a small period of time with a limited budget.
So if there are any organizations listening from across Europe who think that they might be interested in partnering up with you, what should they do?
Yes, this is a very good question, because now we've launched in the Netherlands, in Paradiso, in a music venue in Amsterdam with a lot of these partners. And we're always looking for more partners in the Netherlands. We want to make this Dutch sort of setup that we have now an example, and hopefully an inspiration to similar initiatives across Europe. So whether you're an individual or an organization or a group of people who are looking to do something with the European elections, get in touch with us, provethemwrong.eu, or find us on any socials. But reach out and we can give you branding that can be downloaded for free from our website, videos, we can give you coaching, guidance. We're going to do a lot of events in the Netherlands, but also across Europe. We want to give groups of people or even organizations the tools and the guidance to set up something similar in any European country.
And as if that wasn't enough to keep you busy, you are also putting together a new issue of your very beautiful magazine, Are We Europe, around the elections. And I think you're on the lookout for ideas and contributions for that as well. Am I right?
Yes. So we got a lot of pitches in already over the last weeks, but we're doing this under the Prove Them Wrong name, and we want to focus on the movers and shakers of Europe. So we have a lot of overlap with the people you've interviewed, people like Flavia Kleiner from Operation Libero in Switzerland, but also like specific people from Lithuania and Greece and Denmark, who are still looking for tips and names and organizations of the people that we need to profile in our list of the movers and shakers under 30 or under 35. Across the board in Europe. So it can be civil society organizations, but also individuals, documentary makers. We just don't want to focus on the politicians and the MEPs and the Spitzenkandidaten. We want to focus on the people just behind those people who are working at the front lines of democracy on a day-to-day basis. So if any of your listeners have any leads on that in countries like Lithuania, Denmark, Finland, please reach out as well. And you can still pitch to the issue for sure.
As Mick mentioned, head to provethemwrong.eu if this has sparked an idea, or if you just want to have a look at what they're doing. Their latest issue of Are We Europe hit the shelves a few weeks ago, and this time they're focusing on stories at the intersection of movement and identity. So go get it from your favourite hipster magazine shop or the interweb.
What's your favourite hipster magazine shop?
There's actually a really nice one in Amsterdam, the Athenaeum.
Oh.
And they do sell Are We Europe there.
Oh, good to hear.
I'm looking at firemen this week because firemen have been in the news a few times rescuing people from tricky situations. One of the most notable instances was at the Conservatorium Hotel in Amsterdam, where David Hockney had to be rescued from an elevator that he got stuck in with a whole bunch of British journalists, the poor guy.
Oh, God, worst nightmare.
All he wanted was a cigarette. It was reportedly the editor of the Daily Mail who sounded the alarm and alerted the hotel, who called the firemen for the rescuing operation. There was, however, one fireman rescuing story that I thought was even more of a perfect happy ending tidbit, and it comes from the town of Auerbach in Germany, where a rat who had eaten quite a lot over the winter in order to stay warm and had put on a bit of weight around the hips found itself trapped in the gap of a manhole with its head up to the sky, desperately trying to unlodge itself. Fortunately, help was on its way in the form of the local firemen and an animal rescue team. The 8 rescuers worked hard for 25 minutes to release the plump rat safely. And eventually, they were successful, releasing the rat back into the sewer to go about its day. I said sewer. I sound posh.
Sewer.
One of the animal rescuers told the German press agency, "Even animals that are hated by many people deserve respect. So I guess we can see this as a triumph of human nature, helping the helpless with no conditions." Have you ever needed the help of the fire service, Katie?
Have I ever needed the help of the fire service? Yeah, well, the fire service came, do you remember back in August when I had that potato disaster? When our cellar was, it turned out, full of rotten...
Oh, yeah.
Somebody suggested call the fire brigade, but I don't really know how that would have been relevant. But I've never really worked with the fire service, no. Oh, apart from when our building caught fire. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was a good time.
We were trying to plan the podcast. You're like, my building's on fire.
As soon as I saw the story in my newsfeed, I thought, this is Dominic's happy ending.
It was amazing. There were some really good headlines. Let me just find one. The Guardian went with, "Fat rat stuck in manhole cover rescued by German firefighters."
And do you think fat rat is a bit fattest?
Fat rat. Yeah, I was wondering whether the way I was talking about it, by describing it as plump... But apparently it's a thing that rats put on weight during the winter to protect themselves against the cold. And they call it winter speck, which translates as winter bacon.
Oh, that's lovely.
Maybe we should do that.
I've been doing that for several months now. I'm going to be very late for this wedding if I don't leave right now. But before I do, I would like to give our customary shout out to our Patreon page, where we rattle it in asking for contributions. We have been delighted to see listeners start chipping in over the last few weeks to keep the podcast running. Thank you very much. It really does mean a huge amount to us. Even if it's just $1 a month, every little helps. We are there at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
You can also find us on Instagram, Europeans Podcast, or on Twitter at Europeans Pod, or send us an email, europeanspodcast@gmail.com. As Katie said, she's got to run off to a wedding, so we better go. And we'll be back before you know it with more fascinating guests. We've actually got 2 guests booked up for the next few weeks who we're really excited to talk about. So make sure you hit subscribe in your podcasting application so that you don't miss an episode. Hit auto-download, then you'll never forget.
Hit auto-download, is that a thing?
Yeah, on my app, you can like auto...
I don't think I have us on auto-download. What about confidence? I'm going to do that right now. Thanks, Dominic, for your advice.
Have a nice wedding, Katie.
Thanks, have a nice weekend. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.